It's wonderful if you have the privilege of a mountaintop experience, but you cannot carry on just living on the mountaintop. Back in Deuteronomy, Moses said, "The land you are going over to possess is a land of hills and valleys." And the Christian life is one of mountaintop experiences and sometimes quite dark valleys. We live with faith and doubt, victories and defeats, triumphs and trials, praises and problems, joy and sadnesses. Last week, as we looked at the early verses in chapter 9, we saw something of the splendor and supremacy of Jesus transfigured in the middle of the night on the top of the mountain, and saw how a glimpse of his glory would give sticking power to his followers. Peter might want to prolong the experience, building tents, making it into a camping trip. But up on the top of the mountain, the air is too thin. There's not much to eat. And there's work to be done in the valley. So if you want to share in the glory above, you must be willing to face the suffering below. It is the glory that helps us to face openly the reality of what life is like. Almost 500 years ago, Raphael, the painter, captured these two truths when he did a painting in which the top half had the glory of the transfiguration and the bottom half the suffering of the people. And of course, these two scenes make up the first section in Mark chapter 9. And Jesus, having led them up the mountain, now leads them down into the valley, and they find a different world. They're now, of course, on the way to the cross. And we're going to find that life gets harder from now on. The opposition becomes more vocal. The pressures become more significant. As they come down into the valley, suddenly they are faced with sin and suffering and Satan and sickness. And various things come out at once from the passage. First of all, they are back in the company of large crowds. You may remember that it was after the feeding of the 4,000 that Jesus took them away out of Israel, first of all to Caesarea Philippi, then the woman up in Tyre, and then round to the Decapolis, and now back from the mountain. As they make that journey towards the cross, the time of spiritual retreat and reflection is over. There was a great crowd. They were knee-deep in need. And yet there is an extraordinary statement there. As soon as all the people saw Jesus, they were overwhelmed with wonder. I wonder why they wondered. Remember when Moses came down the mountain, his face was glowing and he wasn't aware of it. Could it be that some after effect of the transfiguration somehow lit up Jesus from the inside? Anyway, now Jesus is immersed in a situation of conflict where two or three are gathered, there's conflict. And that's what there was in this context. In particular, there was a crowd, and in the middle of the crowd were the nine disciples who had not gone up the mountain, and facing them, the teachers of the law and the scribes, and they were pointing fingers. Pointing fingers because the disciples had proved to be abject failures. When faced with human need, they had been frustrated. And so Jesus takes the attention away from the nine cowed disciples and asks the question, "What are you arguing about?" And they immediately find that one man tells the story. And it's a sad story. It's about a father whose heart is broken, as any father would be when they see their child, their only son, we're told in one of the Gospels, far from fulfilling their potential, is hardly even human in their response. "I brought my son who is possessed by a spirit." He's robbed of speech. And when the Spirit comes, it seizes him and it throws him to the ground, and he foams in his mouth, he gnashes his teeth, and he becomes rigid. What a terrifying experience, and how distressing for this man. But here's the rub. I asked your disciples to drive out the Spirit, but they could not. And actually, did you notice that he actually says, "Teacher, I brought you my son"? He never brought him to Jesus. He brought him to Jesus' disciples. But as far as the man was concerned, to bring the need to the disciples of Jesus was the same thing as bringing them to Jesus. And I found myself thinking, I wonder if people look at us and our failure sometimes in terms of real need, whether they then transfer that and say, yes, there's not much to their Jesus. And I come and I find myself with the 9 disciples saying, "Lord, have mercy on me, help me. But I do not want to let you down, and I do not want not to make a difference in our world." Here was a situation of spiritual combat between the disciples and the scribes, between the spirit that took hold of this boy and the need for his deliverance. And through it all is this remarkable loss of confidence in the followers of Jesus, who feel totally impotent before this pressing situation. They were trying their best, they were doing so hard, but they couldn't do anything, and they felt they both let down the Father and they let down their faith. They just messed up. And Jesus by this time was aware that the 3 up the mountain hadn't exactly covered themselves with glory. The 9 at the bottom certainly hadn't. The scribes were just as blind, as intransigent as they had always been. And the crowds were just there for the action. And he finds himself quoting the words that were used by the Lord to the children of Israel when they were at their most difficult, shall I put it tactfully, "You unbelieving generation, how long shall I stay with you? How long shall I put up with you?" For what was the issue here was an issue of belief. For the scribes, they won't believe. For the crowds, they don't believe. And for the disciples, their belief was overwhelmed by the situation. And so Jesus comes, and seeing this young lad, "Bring him to me." It may be that he had literally to be carried. But the moment the Father started bringing the boy towards Jesus, then the healing was beginning. But as the boy comes, he goes into another fitting situation. The boy is in a convulsion. He falls to the ground. He rolls around. He's foaming in the mouth. The word convulse is the word for tearing and lacerating. And you can imagine the crowd almost stepping back in fear at what was in front of them. Sometimes when you read the Gospels, you've just got to step back and see a deeper level of meaning. Here is a father who loves his boy, and the boy is in great need. Does that mirror anything of how the Father of God, our Father, looked down at his nation Israel, called to be a witness to all the nations of the earth, and mute, incapable of carrying out their mission? Is it a picture of how God our Father looks on all his needy sons and daughters around the world? And is it a portent of a Father who one day will watch a son stand mute before his captors facing a certain death upon the cross. Is that fanciful? Who knows? And then, like a good doctor, he starts asking questions. Is this new? Is this a fresh? How long has he been like this? The tale comes back as a harrowing one. This is not the crisis of a moment. This has been a daily pain and sore since the wee boy was a child. From child who's answered has often thrown him into water or fire to kill him. Child's problems were prolonged and pervasive. He was being destroyed by the spirit that possessed him. And then the father, understandably disenchanted both by doctors and disciples, said, "But if you can do anything, take pity on us and help us." He's not sure if Jesus has the power. He believes in the eyes of Jesus he has the compassion. But if the disciples who represented Christ drew a blank, perhaps that threw a question whether Christ could do anything for his boy. Seems to me that the principle basic to being a disciple is this, that the messenger of a man is as the man himself. That we represent Christ to people. We read our Bibles, yes. But the world reads the life of Christians. I remember when I was a teenager at SU camp, one of the songs we used to sing, when they are watching you, marking all you do, hearing the things you say, let them see the Savior as he shines in you. Let his power control you every day. Another chorus said this, you are writing a gospel, a chapter every day by the deeds that you do and the words that you say. Men read what you write, distorted or true. Say, what is the gospel according to you? If you can, the man said, help us. But the boy's pain was also his pain. He was not a detached spectator. He was deeply involved. If you can. Everything, Jesus said, is possible for one who believes. The question is not Jesus' ability to heal, but the Father's ability to believe, because with the despair had come disillusion. He'd asked for help. He'd been let down once, more than once. He didn't want to have his expectations lived again, only to once more find them cast to the ground. So the Father says a verse that's found an echo in many a Christian's heart. Lord, I believe. Help my unbelief. Help me overcome my unbelief. For this man who loved his boy, faith was hard. And what he expressed in that honest statement finds an echo in many people's hearts as they're caught between faith and doubt in that shadowy world of half-belief, where we're never quite sure whether we can see properly or not. It is a mixture of despair and trust. He's saying something like this, Lord, help me just as I am. I am a doubter, but I want to be helped. I have faith, but it's so little. I feel I could trust you, and yet something holds me back. And do you know, it was his honesty that got through to God in Jesus. I have a bit of faith. Could you make it more? I have a bit of love. Could you make it stronger? I have a bit of hope. Can you give me some confidence? Jesus can start with any person where they are, provided they come clean and tell the truth about themselves. You see, You don't need a very big faith. In fact, in the parallel story in Matthew, he says a grain of mustard seed, which is almost invisible to the naked eye, is enough. What you need is faith in a very big God. And it's enough for Jesus. He speaks to the boy in his convulsion and rebukes the impure spirit. Deaf and dumb spirit, I command you, come out of him and never enter him again. I want deliverance and no recurrence. The spirit shrieks, convulsing him violently, and came out. And it looks that in his departure from the boy, what they have instead is death, a corpse, motionless, stationary, no sign of life. He's dead, say some of the crowd. But then, in a picture so true of the heart of the gospel, he who seemed dead is raised to life, and resurrection happens, and the boy is whole. And he's healed. And the madness has gone out of his eyes, and there is no foam left in his lips, and his eyes are clear. And he can hear. And he can form words that can be understood on his lips. What an extraordinary moment. Sometimes you see the gospel change a human being. So it's hard to believe that the person you knew has become what they are now. That's what grace can do. And that's what the gospel can do. But there is questions to be answered before we're finished. After the boy and his father have left, after the crowd have disappeared, the action's over. After the scribes have gone off in their sullen group of rage, hating him even more. The disciples shamefacedly find themselves alone with Jesus in a house. And they look helplessly and say, why couldn't we drive it out? You might be saying, well, I'd be asking the same. But remember, these were the same people who a few weeks earlier had done just that. They had been sent off by Jesus in two, and they had seen, as they said, Satan falling from the sky. So why had they been able to do it then? And not now. Why, when there was two of them, could they see people being delivered, but when there was nine of them, nothing? It doesn't tell us what the answer was, except this kind only come out by prayer. But could it have been that they had become too confident? As if somehow the power of God, which had worked through them a few weeks earlier, they now felt they had harnessed for themselves. It was something they could do, not something that God did through them in the power of the Spirit. This kind can only come by prayer. Was Jesus saying, if I can change the illustration, you forgot to put the plug in? You're not connected to the power of God. You know, the morning you come and you plug in your mobile phone because it's run right down, and you come back an hour or two later and it's still down. You think, what's wrong? And you see, your wife says, well, if you switch it on at the wall, it helps. Your plug's not switched on. You see, the power to live the life of Jesus comes from Jesus. He gives us the power and the joy and the peace. And so it's a very searching question, not a question we ask over coffee. When did you last say to someone over coffee, "How's your prayer life?" You know, we can talk about the rugby. I usually do. But how's the prayer life? I had a tent leader who used to say when he met me and always threw me back, and he was like, "Are you still loving Jesus?" And he'd go, "Oh, goodness, you know." And this kind only come out by prayer. You've stopped trusting God. You've stopped depending Him. Unless you abide in Jesus, you cannot bear much fruit. Remember how Samson, when he was in touch with God, he had great power. And then he gave away his secret to Delilah, and he had his hair cut. And it says, the Lord departed from him, but he wist not. He thought he was just the same. And so when along came the enemy, he got up as he had done before, and he was just a baby. Just a baby, overcome, blinded, bound. Jesus, the Son of God, drew his power from God through prayer. And indeed, perhaps the most disturbing thing of this whole story, it's not the condition of the boy or the mocking of the scribes or the faltering faith of the father, important though they all are. It's the powerlessness of the disciples. One writer says, they underestimated the power of evil in the world and in themselves. Past blessing is no guarantee of future usefulness. It is prayer day by day. It is coming to worship Sunday by Sunday. It is walking with God day by day that enables us to keep connected. Keep connected. And it wasn't doubt that held them back. It was self-confidence. Hudson Taylor, the great missionary to China, said, God isn't looking for people of great faith, but for individuals who are ready to follow him. And that's what the three had to learn when they came down the mountain. And that's what the nine had to learn, who were always in the valley. Here was a situation first of no faith and simply despair, where the father had doubted the power of Jesus but not his character. But then faith was nurtured and his dependence in Jesus became evident. And low faith is better than no faith, and little faith was as much for great power. We're going through a strange phase in the life of the church just now. The impact of COVID is still there. Perhaps above all, we need to just renew our trust in God and say, God, help us. And you may say, well, I really want God to revive his church. I long for the days when people were back as they used to be, even 2 or 3 years ago. I have doubts. Part of the story is this, that doubt doesn't disqualify you. In the letter of Jude, which is quite a hard-hitting letter, it says towards the end, and have mercy on those who doubt. Do you remember how after Jesus rose from the dead, there are these 500 people who come and meet Jesus on the mountain. And when they saw him, they worshipped him. And then it adds these extraordinary words, and some doubted. But Jesus doesn't say, right, those who worship me, stand over here, you'll go off and change the world. And those who doubted, just go away for a wee refresher course so you're ready to go. Not at all. They were all to go. They were to go with their faith, and they were to go with their doubts, and they were to seek that in the company of Jesus, faith would overcome doubt, and faith would overcome fear, and faith would overcome even failure. It only has to be the size of a grain of mustard seed. And it's a choice we make. It's a choice we make between faith and doubt. Why are you troubled, and why do doubts arise in your heart, said Jesus? And sometimes, let's be honest, when we're struggling with doubt, we can borrow faith from other people. In the same way as the four men with faith lowered the man who was paralyzed through the roof, and he drew strength from their faith. Remember how Jesus said to Thomas, stop doubting and believe. You know, biblical faith is belief and unbelief, and choosing to act on the belief bit. So yes, you say, well, I don't know what it's going to be like. Well, hold on to what you know about Jesus. I'm not sure. Hold on and remind yourself of who God is. Well, can it be true? Remember what happened up the mountain. Remember what happened in the cross. Whether it's the glory or the suffering, Christ rules in all of that. Christ can be with you in your need, and in our city's need, and in our world's need. Johnny Erickson Tada, who was paralyzed in a diving accident as a teenager and has shone for Christ for decades, said this: faith isn't the ability to believe long and far into the misty future. It's simply taking God at his word and taking the next step. God is bigger than you, so trust him. And maybe you'll come to the point that Paul was able to say at the end of his life, I'm not ashamed, for I know whom I have believed. Up on the mountain, we saw the glory of Jesus, and we take comfort that there is in heaven itself the Lord of glory. And down in the valley, in the midst of the darkness and the human need and the human conflict, there is Jesus walking in the midst of human need, catching people by the eye and say, do you believe? Lord, I believe. Help me overcome my unbelief. And we do that as a church. Some of you, on a Sunday, encourage me. Give me hope. Some of you, when I say I'm nearly finished, you have hope and then you're disappointed. But I'm talking about real hope. Hope that lasts. Let's together trust that God, who is Lord of the church, King of the nations, has yet more to do in this world of ours for his glory. Amen.